Good morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking about underage drinking, whatever that might be, and Mira Crean is going to be here talking about the Mosaic Dance Company. Right now, I would like to welcome the good folks from Poem Palooza. This is becoming an annual tradition. Valerie Martinez is here. She's the Assistant Professor of English and Creative Writing and the Director of Interdisciplinary Studies at the College of Santa Fe. And we're also joined by Tommy Archuleta and Tamara Bryan from the College of Santa Fe. And Fantasia Lon Jose and Tim McLaughlin are here from the Santa Fe Indian School. Welcome, everybody.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
It's great to have you back. Valerie, Poem Palooza, it's only the third annual. It feels like you've been doing it for 1,000 years.
Well, actually, I have been doing it for about 8 years. I brought it to Santa Fe from the other schools that I've taught at, and so this is the third year here, but it's by far the most successful, and we've had the best audiences here in Santa Fe. A great event.
So what is it? There's more than it's not just like a poetry reading where people demurely walk up to a microphone, read a poem at a podium, and walk away.
No, very different. The whole point of Poem Palooza is to celebrate poetry in all its forms. And so there's dancers who dance to a poem and musicians. We have musical ensembles. We have individual poets reading. We have two slams, an individual and a team slam. We're going to have the UNM slam team here. We have dead poets come to life on the stage.
I love that.
Yeah, this year we have John Donne, John Berryman, Gertrude Stein, and a still living poem, Entezaki Shange. And it's just a really wonderful, fun night.
You mean one of your dead poets is alive?
Yes. So we have to put quotes around it. But we had a staff member, actually, this year who wanted to perform a living poet. So not quite dead, actually, quite alive. And so it's really just a two-hour program, very fun. The audience gets involved in the slams, but also in the other performances. And it's really to show that poetry is very much alive in all the arts and all the disciplines, and to get lots of CSF student poets, local poets, high school poets, community poets together on one stage to have a great time.
And this is happening actually next week. It's Wednesday, the 28th of March, from 7 to 9 at the Greer Garson Theater, right on the College of Santa Fe campus. Tommy Archuleta, you were here last year and reading some poems, and we're really glad to have you back. How long have you been writing poetry?
It's been about 6 years now.
How'd you start?
I started with a friend who's going to College of Santa Fe, who has since graduated, and he gave me a copy of Raymond Carver's selected poems, and that was one factor. There were others, but that was one that comes to mind.
So Raymond Carver touched something inside of you?
Yeah. Quite a bit, actually. We have a lot in common, you could say, in terms of our past, and his clarity and his language was unlike anything I had ever read. But then again, until 6 years ago, I hadn't read much beyond potato chip bags.
Where are you from? Are you from Santa Fe?
Santa Fe, New Mexico.
So you didn't have a whole lot of exposure to literature or poetry in your earlier schooling?
No, I was a high school dropout, and I entered recovery from alcoholism about 10 years ago, and that was really the major factor. And journaling and reading voraciously is when that started, and it just amounted into getting a GED, and from there all of these writers started entering my life and encouraging me to apply at CSF, and I didn't think I'd get it. And much to my surprise, after I applied, I received a congratulatory letter and a full scholarship.
So what year of your studies are you in now?
I am just buttoning up my third year.
So can we hear a poem from you?
Sure. This is a poem totally ripped off from John Berryman.
Yay.
It's called Bar Song. Hank owned not one bathrobe nor a wet wife to throttle by desk lamp and Sinatra. A good man, he once wrote, nothing else. Still, he took his gin black, sang, piss on pathos, boys, it soothes strife, compliments the throw rug in my tubla rasa. No heart, hawked it for slacks, some say of he. Blame the barmaid, claims I no good, no so. Fine, give me back my monkey. That Americans vote says something, says Mr. Doss, as does Hari Kari. Oh, but livers do break, don't they? Pray then for Sapsago. Together we'd be wrenched. If he were here, two dogs on parvo, each other's masters. Look, up ahead, prison, how fortunate. A monotony where planes are mistaken for stars. Best take Rita's photo, ponder her ravenous eye, amber.
Tommy Archuleta. What the whole process of writing poetry is something that we've talked about with various different poets on this program. Do you start with a big concept? Do you start with a word or with a line? How do you begin?
I start by forgetting the fact that I'm trying to write poetry or that I call myself a poet, because once I start doing that, not much writing gets done. It usually is better, and sometimes it's an object. But invariably the idea is to start somewhere and, in my opinion, be taken by the language and not so much the subject matter, as in prose, you know.
Right, right. Well, we've got a bunch of other poets sitting here at the table. Let's turn to Tamara Bryan. You are also a student at the College of Santa Fe.
Yeah, I am.
And how did you begin writing poetry?
Well, I used to, as a kid, my parents would fight over whose books I would read. So it was
really?
Kind of a fight between Anne McCaffrey and Ron and Heinlein. So usually Anne McCaffrey would win.
And that would be your mother?
Yes. And so I came to high school really wanting to write fiction, and I still do. But I came to high school and I had a great teacher there by the name of Michelle Holland. She's kind of associated with, not Poem Palooza, but Poetry Jam, which is coming up soon. And she sort of introduced me to the idea that you could have just moments of language, and that was really fascinating to me, and I've sort of been hooked since.
What do you mean by that, moments of language?
Like, with the novel, you're working with these characters and these words for pages and pages and pages. And with a poem, it's very brief. It's, you just have the attention of the reader for maybe two pages. And it's got to be focused and it's got to be bright and significant for that long.
And so, well, let's hear a poem from you.
Okay, sure. This is a poem called Non Sequitur. Sounds slide off the whole picture. A starlit night becomes pinpricks on a velvet cloth. Words to encapsulate image, image standing as meaning. I will say metaphor, and you will cringe. One more self-referential poem, looping back again and again, like the returning hands of a clock, repeating half days. Or better, like the paws of a mouse, caught in his wheel, touching again and again a familiar spoke. Why then the fabric, picked at until the tiny lights are not stars, but holes in my stanza? And I will say, why the line break? Why technique at all? What clever twist will help you swallow the whole sky? And you will turn away and call me stale, Ask why my poem will constantly shout within itself, I am poem. The lovers embrace, twisted limbs like some Picasso underneath the sky, for novelty. This one, all passion, all ferocity. That one, a virgin who thinks it goes like this. The damp night, weighing on their sweat. The earth, enough romance for heavy breathing. The stars are not holes, I lied, I lied. They're diamonds, they're kings. There are something here that you can touch, feel words until they press into your skin, a prick drawing blood. I will say metaphor. I will say lovers. I will say anything and break the line so you will look at it and hope that somehow you can see it.
Tamara Bryan from the College of Santa Fe. That's always a, I don't know what you would call it, a dangerous path to walk down, poetry about poetry.
Yeah, and I find myself doing it all the time, so I thought I'd write a poem about how I find myself doing it all the time.
That's yet a third level.
Yeah.
Valerie Martinez, are you also going to be reading some poetry in the poetry in the poem Palooza?
Well, this year I will be performing just as John Berryman with Dana Levin as a faculty member. But really, I want to showcase younger poets for the most part, and that's what this is all about.
But you also write your own work?
Yes, I'm a poet, and yeah, that's my life. And so if I can promote poetry in any way, and I have the most wonderful students at the College of Santa Fe and the most wonderful high school poets that I've worked with because of this event. So I feel very lucky. I'm being fed by lots of young poets.
Let's turn now to Tim McLaughlin. He is creative writing teacher at the Santa Fe Indian School. Is poetry your main thing, or you do all sorts of creative writing?
We do all genres of creative writing over the Santa Fe Indian School. And over the past 4 years, we have a spoken word program that's been developing. And we've sort of, which provides forums for creative student expression in all art forms, really. Writing is definitely the center of it. But we've evolved into this concept of what we call an arts fest, where students are performing in various disciplines, poetry, storytelling, music playing, singing, dancing, including native singing and dancing, DJing, filmmaking, and then backdrops of visual arts, and then intersections of those various art forms. So
now, this is, again, something that I've always been a little fuzzy about. What's the difference between poetry and spoken word?
Well, there's the whole debate of is it for the page or is it for the stage? And we try to definitely work on the page first in the classroom and then talk about how does this poem need to change in order to be on the stage, and definitely trying to encourage the kids to write for both forms and create works of art that are working in both places. But certainly poetry is an oral art and is music, and so we try to encourage and develop the students' ability to present their poetry in a musical way.
Now, Fantasia Lon Jose, how long have you been writing poetry?
Well, I started writing mainly in high school. You know, I used to write in middle school, but once I got into high school, I started focusing more on writing, and that's when I really got into writing poetry.
What was your inspiration?
I guess I would say just coming out here to Santa Fe Indian School, it just completely changed the environment, the people I was around, and I had so much influence from the teachers, and basically I just picked it up from there.
Where are you from originally?
I'm from the Zuni Pueblo.
Oh, okay. Now, is there some form of poetic tradition that's native to Zuni?
Yeah, they say there is, and, you know, I talk to elders or grandparents that I have, and, you know, like, this is what our ancestors used to say, and you're just basically picking it up. And
but in a way, you had to go away to find that for yourself.
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
Can we hear a poem from you?
Yeah, sure. Okay, so this one's entitled Brother. My hands were made small, only because I told our mother to give you the substantial, potential hands whose tips could speak for themselves and no one else. Fingers who expressed artistic characteristics of themselves and no one else. Palms who could tell stories of themselves and no one else. Before you came into this world, I saw your hands create my dreams with spray paint cans, diffusing a flow that read, I am the appellation, still in creation. I am your brother, relation. Time passed as your life began to grow in her womb. You were yet to understand the meaning of colors, yet to discover the rhythmic journeys of rivers, yet to hear the steady heartbeat of rocks. And yet, you had your own world being formed for you. Like Nebula, she created your eyes with star things. So your inner breath exhaled in constellation rings that circled the universe, giving you wings so that you could always soar back home. Our last name was the first resemblance I wanted to connect with you, the eminence I wanted to know you by. I was even more blessed when you were born with hair as dark as mine, eyes as brown as mine, skin as deep as mine. Thereby, I can taste what you see, hear what you see, and even feel what you see. And let me tell you, the rain that you see always lands on my tongue. It whispers in my ears and drips onto my skin. Because you were the first vision in my dreams repeating, I am the appellation still in creation. I am your brother, relation. And if you ask me today, I can tell you where and how you came to be. I know exactly who you are. You are the words in my name. You are the voice in my dreams. You are what was created in me.
Fantasia Lan Jose, to what extent does the sort of rap hip-hop culture come into the way you write and think about doing poetry?
I really don't think about that. It's basically what Mr. McLaughlin said. It's music. So you have to, when you're performing, you know, you want to find the rhythm. You want to find the song and the words and, you know, not just basically reading from the page, but, you know, performing it.
So when you're writing, you think about that. You think about the rhythm and of your own voice speaking it.
Yeah, definitely.
And it's almost a different person when you're reading than when you're just speaking and going about your life.
Yeah.
We have enough time for one more poem from everybody. Do you have another one, Tommy Archuleta?
Yeah, I do. In this one, I'm ripping off Galway Canal. I'm just reading these because I'm currently in a class where we're doing imitation poems every week, and it's incredibly difficult. But this is called Kissing Dill. Somewhere this dawn, a boy gathers his nose and ponders, sniffing the dill a girl has pinched from the garden and hands him with both hands, breath, and petulous. But for the ample olive shanks, like the old jet set basking on Panamanian beaches with fanned wires, it senses the boy who might sniff it, tips, quivers, tries to make its essence deaden, only to slog on, oh yes, to slog on.
Tommy Archuleta, let's see. Do you have another poem, Fantasia?
Yeah, I do.
Okay, let's hear it. Yeah, go ahead. Because I forgot to give her Tamara a microphone, so she'll go last.
Okay, so we'll be doing a team slam for poem polism. So this is my portion of the poem. It's called We Pray. So I'll just do my portion. Okay. My culture is prayers sprinkled with cornmeal. Like sand spilled into the sacred lands, I belong with the growing body of Mother Earth. Floating with the breeze to believe in tradition as a continuation of birth. Reborn from my ancestors' words from long ago. Ho'nawan Benawe, our native language speaks of ancient tales. Singing songs from the elderly mountains, valleys, and hills. I dance with sacred rivers to the rhythm and current of a drum beat. I bring the eagle and the sacred sky. Having wings is to escape reality. Spirituality is one times infinity, revolutions of this world, and where my words are continually written, spiraling around and around my identity. Don't read me like an ordinary book. The pages in my life are not even squared, but they are as round as the stars, the completion of the moon, and the circular embracement of this world, slowly beating with life. Prayer floats in the air, followed by cornmeal spilling to the ground like holy water. Knowing we belong to repeat at certain moments. Knowing we belong in the bloodline of family, of relatives.
Fantasia Lon Jose. And we're going to close with Tamara Bryan.
Okay. This is a poem I call On Either End. A night on the couch, we were sloppy spontaneous. I ran a brush through my hair, first thing the next morning. When was distance not involved? It takes exactly one gas tank going or coming. Even this night has echoes. Even something gone the next morning makes me want to turn one key, open one door, plop down on a bed that is mine all year, every year. I know the way the desert opens like a book as I slice through it, counting miles by the tens. There isn't a home on either end in any set of arms.
Tamara Bryan. Well, I'd like to thank you all so much for being here. We have Valerie Martinez, who is at the College of Santa Fe. She's a professor of English and creative writing and director of interdisciplinary studies. Poets Tommy Archuleta, Tamara Bryan, Fantasia Lon Jose, and Tim McLaughlin, who is creative writer and instructor at the Indian School. And all of this is about Poem Palooza, which is a celebration of poetry. All sorts of different forms of poetry are happening, and that is Wednesday of next week, the 28th of March, from 7 to 9 in the evening at the Greer Garson Theater. We want to thank you so much for being with us here on KSFR. We're going to take a little break right now. Stay tuned to KSFR. The time is 8:30.
KSFR programming is underwritten in part by Garcia Street Books, located at 376 Garcia Street, where Santa Fe living treasure Marcia Muth will launch A World Set Apart, Memory Paintings, on Friday, March 23rd at 5 p.m. And on Saturday, March 24th at 5 p.m., John Agresto will celebrate his national book launch of Mugged by Reality, The Liberation of Iraq and the Failure of Good Intentions. More information at 986-0151 or garciastreetbooks.com.
The next Lannan Readings and Conversations features Carl Safina, the president of the Blue Ocean Institute and author of Song for the Blue Ocean. His main focus is using science, art, and literature to inspire a sea ethic, a closer relationship with the sea. His newest book, Voyage of the Turtle, is an impassioned account of the plight of ocean-dwelling turtles. Join Carl Safina for an evening of interesting talk about the seas and literature, Wednesday, March 28th at the Lensic. For tickets, you can call 988-1234.
KSFR programming is underwritten by Locals Care. Locals Care community cards reward you for shopping and dining at over 100 locally owned businesses. You can support a Santa Fe nonprofit and earn rewards for yourself at any Locals Care business. Find program information and a current list of participating businesses and nonprofits at locals-care.com. Offered in cooperation with the Santa Fe Alliance and sponsored by Century Bank, Los Alamos National Bank, the New Mexican, and the City of Santa Fe.
I'd like now to welcome Glenn Waringa. He's a health educator with the New Mexico Department of Health right here in Santa Fe. And the occasion of our conversation today is that the acting Surgeon General has issued a call to action about underage drinking. Welcome, Glenn.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Now, I was reading some of the stuff about underage drinking, and the drinking age is 21, and they were talking about how drinking hurts the developing minds of 15-year-olds.
Mm-hmm.
So what does underage mean in the first place?
Well, underage basically means anything less than 21. There's a gray area in there, so to speak, where young people become adults at the age of 18, but they're not allowed to drink between the ages 18 and 21, so there's a somewhat different set of laws that apply, but it's illegal for anybody under the age 21 to drink alcohol in the state of New Mexico.
What about at home?
Parents can serve their youth alcohol in their own residence or on their own property. I could do that with my daughter, who's now 28, but if I wanted to, when she was younger, I could serve her alcohol under my supervision. But if your son or daughter were at my house, it would be illegal for me to do that.
Now, I think one of the reasons that this whole thing is an issue is because there's not only underage drinking, but there's underage abuse of alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
What's the difference between use and abuse?
Well, for the purposes of this brief show, if we could look at the underage population as being three groups. One, kids that don't drink at all, and there are a significant number of those. Kids that do drink, and then kids that drink in a binge-like manner. And a binge-like manner is heavy drinking. This is when it's scientifically defined as five or more drinks at a single setting. And a majority of our youth tend to drink in a binge-like way, and usually the goal of that is to get intoxicated. So those are the ones that we're very concerned about, the ones that are, quote, binging, the ones that are drinking heavily. Not only is that a big problem nationally in New Mexico, that part of the underage drinking problem seems to be increasing. In other words, maybe 10 years ago, young people would binge once or twice a month, usually on weekends, but now it seems to be increasing. So the number of situations in a 30-day period of time is higher than it used to be.
So it used to be on weekends, now it's what?
It's still basically on weekends, but instead of, you know, every other or every third weekend, once in a while, now it seems to be becoming more of an ingrained pattern in the youth culture as to how those that do drink heavily more often. And one of the things you had asked about was the age. In the Surgeon General's report, we now have about 10% of our 9- and 10-year-olds starting to drink. I mean, 9- and 10-year-olds, that's really, really young.
Why are they doing it?
Well, I think there's a lot of different reasons they do it. We can't ignore alcohol advertising, which is pervasive. We can't ignore the fact that some parents are not as available as they could be for a variety of reasons, working two or three jobs. We used to have two parents in a family, and now oftentimes we don't. A lot of young people, there's a certain type of young person that has a personality in which they're kind of impulsive, aggressive, risk takers. That's about the age where that starts to come out, and The alcohol advertising appeals particularly to those young people with an image of kind of being rebellious and the like. And I think until we look at the reasons that young people drink in a rather thoughtful and deep manner, that we're missing the boat with a lot of our prevention programs.
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, when you think about a 10-year-old binge drinking, it seems like a real stretch to attribute that to advertising.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the kid's got to have some serious problems.
Oh, yeah. You know, advertising provides a context, and all kids, for the most part, are exposed to it. But the ones that are most vulnerable are the ones that I described the personality profile just briefly, and the ones that are probably coming from families in which perhaps there's a parent or two that's drinking in a binge-like manner, and along with that kind of binge-like drinking comes a lot of other behaviors that kids have a hard time dealing with, and sometimes they act out.
So in other words, children of alcoholics are more likely to drink?
Children of alcoholics are 4 to 10 times higher than the average population for developing alcohol-related problems. You nailed that one.
Now, when I was a kid, the drinking age was 18. And I went to college, and In the words of Chef in South Park, there is a time and place for everything, and that time is called college.
Mm-hmm.
And we did, you know, we drank. I mean, it was fabulous. It was great. There was nothing wrong with it. Is there not a danger, and I'm asking a leading question here, of infantilizing young adults by basically imposing prohibition on them?
Infantilizing.
Treating them like children, depriving them of taking responsibility for their own lives.
Okay.
Treating them like kids.
Well, to a certain extent, if we look at, let's say, the underage 18 group, and let's even further define that under the age of 15. If you start drinking prior to the age of 15, you're five times as likely to develop alcohol-dependent problems as you age and become an adult. So in a lot of ways, teens are children. They might not be the same.
No, I'm not talking about 50. I'm talking about 18-year-olds.
Okay.
Go to college. You're able to get drafted, go get killed in a war. You're able to get married and have kids. You're able to hold down a job, but you're not allowed to drink for another 3 years.
Well, let me approach it from a couple of perspectives. One is that of brain development. We know for the fact that, from research, that our brains are still in process of becoming whole till about the age of 25. And alcohol, particularly often in heavy binge drinking, retards that. So as 18 to 21-year-olds, we need to know that there's a trade-off there, the buzz versus developmental processes that might get thwarted. The other piece of that is that in the 18 to 21-year-old group, that's on the front end of the group that has the highest alcohol problems in the country. That 20 to 23-year-old is where binge drinking peaks and where we have a lot of our problems. So we have to know that in that 18 to 21-year-old group, when people leave home frequently for the first time, whether it's to go into the working environment or go to college, as you said, heavy drinking is accompanied by a lot of other things. It's accompanied by violence. It's accompanied by sexual assault. It's accompanied by the transmission of sexually transmitted disease. So it's not just that we're worried about the biological brain effects of heavy drinking. We're worried about the accompanied things that frequently come when people don't have their full faculties about them and do some silly things. And sometimes,
but I mean, that doesn't happen for most people. That's a minority of people. I mean, your average 18-year-old is going to be able to learn how to drink responsibly, and they should.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, aren't we the only country that even does this? You can go to Mexico, you can go to any country south of El Paso, and young people are allowed to drink, and they learn how to do it.
Well, if you're asking about the legal drinking age in the United States, it is 21, and that is on the higher range of other countries in the United States. But what we have to do is take a look at whether that legal drinking age has a positive effect on reducing alcohol-related harm. And we know from when we raised that I think it was 10, 15 years ago, we reduced traffic fatalities over that period of time among that age group by about 14%. So we know that those kind of policy issues do have a positive effect on reducing alcohol-related harm. The other thing that we need to worry about is that many youth who drink also drive. And if it was only a bunch of kids getting together in their own dorm or their own home and getting blasted and then doing nothing thereafter, staying home, having a pizza, going to bed, whatever, that's one thing. But we know a lot of these people don't just do that. They drink heavily, and then they go out and they drive because of lack of public transportation in many places, particularly in New Mexico, particularly in the rural parts of New Mexico. So when they do that, they not only hurt themselves, but potentially they're going to involve you or I in a DWI crash, and there's been no shortage of those over the last couple months.
During Prohibition in our country, drinking went down and all these problems went down, but we decided as a country not to have prohibition. Basically, you're talking about a kind of prohibition for an age group, and it's still, you know, the question is still up. It's like you're treating young people as if they are unable to be responsible for their own lives.
Well, some young people can be responsible for their own lives.
I mean, how do you not teach them? First of all, an 18-year-old who wants to drink is going to drink, whether it's legal or not. Second, they can also get their hands on illegal drugs, and they're going to.
Mm-hmm. There's no shortage of illegal drugs out there either. alcohol and drugs are easily accessible. What the Surgeon General report is trying to say is that, and they only issue a call to action every other year. So this is not like these things come out on a weekly basis. This is a major, major publication out of the Surgeon General's office. The last one, when
I tried to read it. It's a million pages long.
Yeah, it's 110 pages long, and I've read it cover to cover twice. But the last one that came out was in 2005. So when the Surgeon General picks an issue, what he's trying to do is get the focus on it, because it's been, in a sense, underexposed, underdeveloped in the eyes of the public and the media and teachers and parents and the like. So hence he's chosen this one. And if you read the report, there's a lot in there about the psychosocial development of teens, you know, their brain growth, et cetera, et cetera. So this is a particularly crucial issue. And it's highly correlated with a whole bunch of other problems that we would like to reduce as well. As I mentioned before, the sexually transmitted disease, sexual assault, unplanned, unwanted pregnancies, et cetera, et cetera. So if we can reduce the alcohol rate among youth, we could probably reduce a lot of these other behaviors at the same time.
So how do you do that?
Well, there's a lot of different things you could do. One is a policy approach, and we talked a little bit about that before. We raised the drinking age to age 21. There's a number of other things that can be done. You can take a look at the alcohol policy within schools, and I sit on a committee within Santa Fe in which we're doing that. There's a tremendous need for educators, teachers, to be more savvy, to perhaps get additional training in how to spot young people who are involved with substance abuse, whether it be alcohol or anything else. And basically, we would be looking at impairment. If you are a good student up until your sophomore year and you get involved with substances over the summer, and you come back your junior year and you go from A's and B's to C's and D's, there's something going on there where you've quit being a top performer. So the teachers and guidance people need to be employed to intervene with those kids when something like that comes about.
So how do they intervene?
Well, there's a number of ways. They can express their concern about declining academic performance directly to the student. Now, there could be a lot of reasons for this. There could be the fact that someone's got a job after school and is working from 4 to midnight and they're fatigued all the time. So it's not necessarily we want educators accusing young people of being drunks or stoners or anything like that. We want them to be able to express their concern directly that you're not getting the best education you can. You're not taking advantage of that. And perhaps at that point in time, depending upon how the conversation goes, that might be enough for a young student who in Santa Fe basically doesn't believe that many teachers care about them from the survey data we have. And that might be enough for them to kind of say, oh, somebody cares about me. I better check this out. Also, we have a pilot project going on with Santa Fe High School. It's called the eChug. And this is an assessment tool that's taken over the web. And the students get a printout after they enter their individual data about how much and how often they drink, family risk factors, a whole host of things, and it gets back. They get a printout back, confidential printout, that tells them, here's the situation that you are in. If you're a non-drinker, you don't get much of a printout, but if you're drinking at all, it's feedback to you that if you continue to drink in this manner, particularly a binge-like manner, you're probably going to endure some problems and some hardships.
If people want to find out more about all of this, you're a health educator. Where should they start?
Well, it depends upon what they need. If they need information, they can call me. If it's okay to give my number, 476-2625. I can refer them as to where to get the Surgeon General's report. It's on the web. Just have to Google the Office of Surgeon General. It'll take you there. There's a number of committees in Santa Fe that are working on the underage drinking problem. We're always looking for more people to join us. As a matter of fact, we have our fingers crossed that we might be getting the Surgeon General to visit Santa Fe in the next few months to talk more about this report and perhaps hold a town meeting. The Department of Health is working with the Office of the First Lady on this project, and we will see whether we can get him or not. If we could, it would be a really good thing for Santa Fe.
Well, Glenn Waringa, thank you so much for being with us here on KSFR.
Thank you.
Glenn
Waringa, it's a pleasure as always.
It's a pleasure to see you too. Glenn Waringa is a health educator with the New Mexico Department of Health. We're going to take a quick break right now. Stay tuned to KSFR. We're going to be talking about belly dancing in just a moment.
KSFR programming is underwritten in part by Body, local spa, yoga, Nia, and organic cafe. Kane Mathis plays an African Kora concert at Body Saturday, March 24th at 8 p.m. Kane has studied music in Africa for 15 years and played the Kora, a traditional 21-string African harp, for U.S. and Gambian ambassadors. Starting this month, Body also offers an expanded cafe menu, more seating, and live music at dinner. For information, 986-0362 or bodyofsantafe.com.
Looking for something to do in Santa Fe? You can visit santafeculture.org. Scan the calendar for fun things to do, buy tickets, plan a trip, search for an artist, gallery, movie, restaurant, or browse local resources, list free classifieds, even learn about kid-friendly things to do, and there's much more. It's free, it's easy, it's Santa Fe in just one click. Online at santafeculture.org. Brought to you by Santa Fe Economic Development Division and New Mexico Culture Net, tax-exempt organization.
I'd like now to welcome Mira Crane. She is the director of the Mosaic Dance Company, who will be performing their annual spectacular performance this weekend, Saturday and Sunday at the James A. Little Theater. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
It's great to have you here.
Oh, thank you.
What is belly dancing? Where is it from?
Well, belly dancing is something that comes from the Middle East, and there are many different dances that are done in different countries. So Turkish style would differ from Egyptian style, Tunisian style, etc., etc. Some are more tribal dances, and as the culture evolved, you know, there became, in Egypt especially, a style called Egyptian style belly dance, which is mostly what I work in. And there's a folkloric style and a modern style. And we do a lot of different dances. This show is going to exhibit some of those dances.
Now, belly dancing originally as danced, let's say, folkloric style in Egypt, in Turkey. What was it for? Was it a performance thing? Was it something? What was the origin of it?
I think there are a lot of different ideas about that. And I think that my looking at the historical information that we actually have, I would say that dance just, it was something that accompanied all aspects of life. You know, we really didn't have television and entertainment of that sort, so we entertained each other. We made music, you know, we played instruments for each other, we danced for each other. And I think that these dances accompanied things that were both sacred and secular.
Now, there's a sacred aspect of it.
You know, I would say that there's a sacred aspect to life, and so therefore there's always a sacred aspect to it. I myself experience that when I'm performing greatly, but not everyone does. And I wouldn't say that, I wouldn't go so far to say that there was priestess dancing in temples and that sort of thing. A lot of people like to talk about it that way, but there's no real evidence to that effect. But on the other hand, I mean, there are sacred aspects to all of life, and I think that dance always celebrates our act of living.
Now, how did you get interested in belly dance?
My mother was a belly dancer.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
I've been doing it
since I was 3. I started performing when I was 11. I started teaching when I was 14, and I'm 44. So I've been doing it most of my life. I've been teaching for 30 years.
Do you have any actual ethnic Middle Eastern roots in your ethnic, something that you just, your mother just took up?
Well, I come from a very unusual family. Mostly my family has concerned itself with the East. My grandfather was Alan Watts, and my great-grandmother was Ruth Fuller Sasaki, and she was the first woman and the first foreigner to be ordained a Buddhist priest in Japan. And she started the first Zen Institute in New York. And so my family has always been multicultural. I grew up wearing saris and kimono and different kinds of things. People from all over the world came through our home. And I just grew up that way, you know. So I've always had an interest in different cultures and, you know, the expression of people.
So when did you found Mosaic Dance Company?
I think Mosaic is almost 10 years old.
And was it originally, was the idea to be a teaching thing or a performance thing or both?
Mosaic is a professional performance company. And then I have two pre-professional companies. One is called Ahate. Ahate's been around for a while now. And this year we formed Almaz Asahara. And Almaz Asahara is a company dedicated truly to Egyptian-style dance.
Now, do you speak Arabic?
No, I don't, unfortunately. I would love to speak Arabic. I speak a few words now, but it's my dream, actually, to start studying Arabic.
The music is so integrated into the dance that the dancers actually have to become musicians themselves to some extent.
Oh, to a huge extent, actually. We are the light expression of the sound. So when you hear a certain instrument, there are certain, words in the language, if you will, that go along with those sounds. And so we are really, if a dancer is really worth her salt, she knows every instrument. She knows how to play it on her body. I mean, it's really a musicianship. And there's a real interaction, if it's done correctly, between the dancer and the musicians. It's primarily originally an improvisational form. And it's a folkloric form, so of course we're always talking about sort of dances of the people versus its highest art. You know, and I think the highest art is when everybody gets together and they're all really excellent musicians and excellent dancers, and they work off of each other and, you know, take it somewhere.
And the dancers also use finger cymbals and
right.
drums and so on.
Finger cymbals in Turkey are called zils. In the Arabic language, they're called sagat. And yes, we play those.
You work a lot with teenagers.
I do.
And there's a program called the SEED program, S-triple-E-D, something like that, Self-Empowerment Education.
It's Self-Esteem, Empowerment, and Education
right.
through Dance.
Yeah, right, right.
It's a teen program. As a matter of fact, this concert this weekend is partially a benefit for that program. We didn't have enough money to finish the program this year. And so we donated a lot of the tickets from, a lot of the proceeds from this show are going to that program. Actually, all the profit from the show will be donated to the program to help it see its way through to the end of this particular session. SEEDS is a really powerful and effective program for teenage women. It teaches them about their bodies, you know, and helps them with their self-esteem. And we have all kinds of incredible mentors come in. We had Allie McGraw yesterday. It was very exciting. She came in and talked about her life's work with the girls, and she was incredible. She had so many beautiful things to say to them. And we draw in people, you know, women who are extremely successful in all kinds of different fields to come in and talk about, you know, their success and their failure, you know, and how they've created themselves, you know, so that these girls have models. And we do a lot of financial planning. You know, I know a lot of people think, oh, belly dancing, you know, but we use it in a wonderful way to get the girls really involved in their bodies and to understand themselves, help them with their self-esteem, and then to get in there and talk about life skills like financial planning, how to save money, how to balance a checkbook, you know, all of these important things that we have to face as people.
The dance, belly dancing, the costumes you wear, the way you move is such a tremendously... Well, it's just an incredible expression of female sexuality, sensuality. Mm-hmm. What does that do especially for the teenagers who are studying it?
Thank you for asking that question. You know, I think it's especially effective for young women because as we come to that age, we go through this sort of portal where our bodies begin to change without our permission. You know, we start to menstruate and our bodies develop. And this can be a very difficult transition for young women. And I think that when so much is happening to us that is not within our control, to be able to learn to control our bodies gives us a sense of balance. And when we control our bodies in that way, we begin to have respect for ourselves. And when we respect ourselves, we make better decisions. And we have higher self-esteem, and so we don't do things we shouldn't do, you know? And I think that because all those hormones are raging and we do need a place, you know, to put all of our sort of sexual energy, if you will, again, to be able to place it somewhere that is safe, that is, you know, really an expression that allows us to express it and move it through our being, And I think young women are terribly concerned with their looks, you know. I see it every time, you know, the girls come in. They're just so afraid of each other, what each other will think, the judgment. And they're so concerned about how they're not pretty enough and that kind of thing. And, you know, I think that this environment provides them a sense of that they're all beautiful and that beauty is not really reliant on the kinds of superficial things that our media tells us it is.
And they also presumably develop a lot of camaraderie with each other and support of each other rather than competition.
They most certainly do. That is really true in our studio. We are... We are really the caretakers of that, you know. We really try to promote that as much as possible. And through the program itself and just the dance style that they're involved in, it's very helpful because tribal itself is not a solo dance form and it's improvisational. So they have to work together as a group in this extremely intimate way. And so they have to learn to trust each other. And here they do these talking circles every day where they talk about issues like what are you afraid of? How do you handle your fear? You know, it's very exposing, you know, and at first it's terrifying.
At any age.
At any age, yeah. And at first it's terrifying for them, but by the time they're done, they can barely stand to be parted from each other. So it's really a wonderful experience, you know, for them of love and friendship.
We've got just a moment left before we go, but I wanted to ask you, you've been doing this for so long. What does it feel like when you're dancing and when you're performing?
Well, that's actually kind of a very personal question, actually. You know, what I go for, and I don't always get it, is that I try to really leave myself out of the equation, and I try to create my... I try to become a conduit for sort of this energetic sharing between my audience and myself. And I really try to go for this experience where I feel something more than myself, you know. For me, it's a spiritual act.
It seems like that's something that... You can't really try to do. It either happens or doesn't.
You can't. You can't try, but you can prepare. You know, I mean, living the life of a dancer is a tremendous discipline. And one of the things that I feel really strongly about is that it's a devotion. It's a devotional act. And so all of that disciplining can hopefully prepare oneself so that perhaps that will happen more often, you know.
Mira Crean is the director of the Mosaic Dance Company. They will be performing this weekend. The performance is called Invaders of the Heart. It's on March 24th and 25th. That's this Saturday and Sunday at the James A. Little Theater on the campus of the School for the Deaf. And both performances are at 7 o'clock. If you want any more information, you can call 986-6164. Thank you so much, Mira, for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We are on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me by email at the email address radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, John Greenspan with Good Morning Jazz. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. Hasta mañana. Ciao. Thank you.